Hello and welcome to ICTJ Forum, a new feature headlining our World Report, a monthly digest of transitional justice news from across the globe. In this monthly podcast, we will speak to our experts to discuss and analyze the most important, most interesting, most relevant transitional justice developments in the month featured in the World Report. We will analyze these events from a transitional justice perspective, hoping to offer our audiences an insight from ICTJ. In this inaugural broadcast with us today, we have from left to right, Marcy Mirsky, director at the Program Office of ICTJ. Welcome, Marcy.
Thank you, Rafik.
Virginie Ladish, director of Children and Youth Program at ICTJ. Welcome, Virginie.
Thank you very much.
And Paul Seals, vice president of ICTJ. Welcome, Paul.
Thank you.
And my name is Rafik Hodgett, and I will be host and moderator of this discussion. There has been a number of events in the past month that deserve our attention in ICTJ Forum. We will today focus on several of them, including the announcement by the Colombian President Santos of new peace negotiations with FARC guerrillas. We will discuss what implications transitional justice issues have on the peace negotiations and vice versa. From another corner of the world, we have a new proposed legislation on the setup of a truth commission in Nepal that basically comes out of the two bills that have existed for some time. This new ordinance has attracted a number of reactions, and we will be talking about that. As well as that, we will briefly comment on the first annual report of the newly created Special Rapporteur on issues of truth, justice, reparations, and guarantees of non-recurrence before the UN Human Rights Council. But we will start with a significant event that is yet to happen. Namely, on the 19th of September, the UN Security Council will hold its annual open debate on children in armed conflict. The theme of this year's session will be increased accountability for violations against children. ICTJ is the first non-governmental organization that has been invited to present as part of a debate. Virginie, could you please give us a broader background on the significance of the debate itself and possible outcomes and tools that UN Security Council has when dealing with the issue of violations against children in armed conflict?
Yes, thank you. This debate is now an annual event that takes place after the Secretary General releases his report on children in armed conflict. It gives a chance for member states to discuss the conclusions, draw attention to special country cases that have emerged, and also make recommendations on certain steps to be taken. And it's extremely significant that this is now, like I said, part of an annual process that shows the degree to which the Security Council has been paying increasing amount of attention to this issue of children and armed conflict and has developed a unique set of tools and approaches to combat these violations. So first among those is the naming and shaming exercise, a process by which in this annual report, the Secretary General will list countries or parties that are guilty of committing the among the six grave violations against children. The ones currently that can put a country on this list of naming and shaming include recruitment of children, killing and maiming, sexual violence, and attacks on schools and hospitals as of last year's resolution. So then the idea is once these countries are on the list of perpetrators of these violations, the Secretary General and the SRHD's office, they try and enter into agreements, into action plans with these countries to stop the recruitment, stop the violations, and get off the list.
Does it apply to countries only or what we refer to as non-state actors as well?
It applies to both state and non-state actors. And actually that's a problem that's emerged in this year's report is a question of persistent perpetrators. So people have been put on this list of name and shame for over 5 years are now called persistent perpetrators. And in this year's report, There are now 52 names, and 32 of those are persistent perpetrators. There's been more success with the state actors, where they're the threat of international sanctions and loss of credibility have led to a platform to negotiate action plans. But with the non-state actors, it's harder to reach them and harder to negotiate action plans. That's another area where this year's debate is looking to find some alternative tools and approaches.
We have been invited to, in a way, offer a case for transitional justice, especially when it comes to issues of accountability as a way of preventing these violations. What is the importance of this fact and the fact that ICTJ, for the first time, is representing a non-governmental sector in this debate?
I think over the past year, we've been closely collaborating with the SRG's office on some of their working papers and reports that have been looking a bit more at the question of accountability. And since that is the focus of this year's debate, I think they've invited us to provide another perspective on steps that can be taken to address these violations. So I think one thing we want to look at, and this is where ICTJ is well-placed to offer some suggestions, is the disconnect between international standards and rule of law and what's happening on the national level. And more locally, nationally owned and driven processes will be better positioned to put some pressure, to expose what's happening, and in that process, hopefully contribute to stopping the violations.
Paul, when we talk about the contribution of transitional justice to increasing accountability for violations against children, what is it, in fact, that transitional justice has to offer in this context?
But transitional justice looks at this, I think, in a slightly different way from, I guess, what could be called a slightly shorter term focus, in terms of trying to look not only at accountability for those people who have been committing the violations, but also looking at the underlying causes of what leads to them being committed in the first place, the very complicated circumstances that give rise to things like child recruitment. You know, we can sometimes run the risk of looking at that in a relatively narrow kind of focus without looking sufficiently clearly at the context that allows children to be recruited, or the conditions in which parents might, in fact, not oppose as strongly as they otherwise would the recruitment of their children into armed forces, and all sorts of other complications. So I think one of the things transitional justice is trying to do, and the mechanisms or the activities around transitional justice, is to try and expose the truth behind the violations themselves, try to create a context for a discourse that allows exploration of solutions to those, rather than just looking at punishment per se. Things like recruitment of child soldiers, among the different kinds of violations that Virginie has mentioned, has to be made just socially unacceptable. It's not just an issue of calling it a crime or calling it a violation. It has to register at a certain point as just being beyond the pale and unacceptable. That's not an easy thing to do. It will take generations of work, possibly, hopefully not that long, a more profound analysis and a more consistent analysis of the causes of it is some of the things that transitional justice can bring to bear.
Would you say that there are examples of where transitional justice has actually contributed in different other contexts to such, so to say, social change, where practices are now unacceptable due to the knowledge coming out or criminal justice action?
I would say the whole issue of forced disappearances is largely brought out by transitional justice activities. But if you go back, the beginning of transitional justice in many ways has an awful lot to do with issues like forced disappearance, going through the Latin American incidences of transitional justice, if you like, in Argentina and Chile and then Guatemala and Salvador. I wouldn't pretend for one second that transitional justice is the vehicle or the leading vehicle or the only vehicle that can discuss these things, but it's a way in which an exploration of the issues can be allowed to occur and allows certain mechanisms such as significant reports, commissions of inquiry, truth commissions or criminal prosecutions, systematic prosecutions, can allow the underlying causes and the underlying phenomena to be explored in a way that and come to the fore in a way that might not otherwise happen.
How many member states are expected to attend, and does that reflect the degree of interest in this issue? Is it a growing degree of interest by member states in this?
It's 50 to 70 member states, so they expect the debate to last until about 7 o'clock at night, and it is, as far as I was told, one of the most well-attended thematic open debates. And from different reports, I mean, so far over the past few years, the focus on children armed conflict has evolved as the most robust and innovative thematic approach within the UN system.
Well, moving on to the next issue in this conversation, I just want to remind our listeners that they can find out more about ICTJ's presentation and the debate on our website, where we will have the integral text of the presentation presented by ICTJ's president, David Tolbert, at the debate. The next issue is Colombia. President Juan Manuel Santos has announced that peace negotiations are to be opened with the leftist FARC guerrillas, standing to end what is more than four decades of ongoing conflict. Paul, I'll turn to you first and ask, what do you think are the main issues to be addressed as part of these negotiations when it comes to prospects for durable peace in Colombia?
I think one thing that has to be understood about the negotiations that have been announced by the president is that it comes in a context of an ongoing process that has been, at least in one view of it, going on for since 2002, and that's the demobilization attempts in respect of the paramilitaries. The two processes are connected politically and perhaps substantively. What makes a durable peace? I think it's perhaps slightly a premature question in the sense that we have to really see what the intentions of the parties are behind the negotiations. One of the things I would say, World Development Report came out last year and highlighted the idea of durable peace and development depending on security, jobs and justice. And one of the things at the heart of the Colombian process, I think, has been overlooked, and I think perhaps deliberately overlooked in the political conception of the demobilization process of the paramilitaries, was how seriously damaged the Colombian state has been by the conflict, by its official associations, through corrupt politicians, through corrupt institutions, in really weakening the democratic issues and the rights of citizens. That has to be fully exposed, and that's an integral part of the process of transitional justice, an integral part of the peace. So demobilization, security in respect to FARC, of course, is absolutely essential to the process. But for a lasting process that really represents the strengthening of Colombian democracy and an effective respect to the rights of the all Colombian citizens, really requires a very, very effective exposition and remedying of the corrupted nature of the Colombian state. So I think it's a mistake to focus just on the FARC side of this. The information that's come out throughout this, it has to be seen in an overall context, and a large part of that still has to be shining a light on what we've learned about and what still has to be found out about the nature of the state's involvement and the nature of the state's failures in supporting human rights and fundamental rights and freedoms in the context of a democratic state.
Marcy, these are peace negotiations where peace is the ultimate prize. Issues of accountability that we are talking about may be seen at the same time as a crucial element for the success of negotiations, but also they are often seen by some as a threat to negotiations. What is your opinion? Are they seen? Are they an obstacle or an opportunity?
Well, I think there's two really important things in terms of opportunity to take into account here. One is, on the one hand, that it's an opportunity for Colombia really to establish a new normal. I think for a lot of people, there's not an understanding that with 50 years of armed conflict, it became normal in the life of the country for there to be war going on within their borders from internal forces. And that it became normal for hundreds and thousands of new victims to be produced each year, and that there is a machinery to the production of victims. This makes it possible, if peace is achieved with justice and sustainably, for a new normal to be established and for a society to understand that it is not normal for there to be ongoing armed conflict. It's not normal to be producing thousands of victims each year through the armed conflict. And it's not normal or acceptable to resort to violence to resolve political and economic disputes. I think from our own experience in the country, though, we can see at least two serious issues that emerged in the attempt to equate peace with the demobilization of an illegal armed actor. And one of those was to try and over-judicialize, to use the courts to resolve a problem that goes way beyond the capacity of the court, so that in the justice and peace process, they have applied and continue to apply modified judicial processes in exchange for demobilization, and didn't take into account either whether that in itself would be an effective tool or looking at other justice mechanisms that could have been brought to bear. And the other, I think, that has emerged from our experience there are the limitations of a piecemeal approach. That if you only look at and examine the role of one party in a very complex conflict, you have very little possibility of either even demobilizing that party or of really resolving the underlying conflict. Why has it continued so long? It's not only because you couldn't get these folks to stop fighting, but there are a lot of other underlying issues, and also what the role of each of the parties to this conflict has been, including the state. Then I think there'll be a chance, if that examination is done and then corrective measures are taken, to actually build some kind of sustainable peace. And within that, transitional justice brings a series of instruments to bear for exploring those causes, for providing guidance for redress. And I think in this context where there's an attempt to look at not only demobilization but actually building peace, that this opens an opportunity as well for a more integrated approach to transitional justice that brings a greater possibility of these mechanisms being brought to bear in a constructive fashion.
There is an ongoing process in the country. Transitional justice initiatives of different sort at different stages. How do you think the peace negotiations or any possible outcome will affect what is going on and efforts at the reform of justice and peace law and discussions around it, or the other way around, how these ongoing processes may affect the peace negotiations?
Yeah, I think one of the ways in which the ongoing process, I think, can have a positive impact is to reorient the justice and peace process to identify and prosecute those who are most responsible for the crimes that have been committed. Our own position on this, ICTJ's position on this, has been that within the paramilitary groups, the most responsible doesn't only mean the military heads, but the most responsible needs to also be applied to those who may be behind those structures, those who provided funds for the political support, and the different individuals who play an absolutely key role in the creation and sustaining of these illicit armed groups. And that if indeed the Attorney General's office decides on such prioritization criteria and applies them effectively, that will make a huge contribution to disarticulating these groups which have caused so many violations and so much suffering for Colombia.
The peace negotiations with FARC are not an isolated incident, so to say. There have been different other processes of similar nature, most notably the process of demobilization of right-wing paramilitaries. Are there any lessons to be learned? Is this a process that should be looked to when dealing with FARC?
I think, as Marcy suggested in some of her comments earlier, that there are issues around the degree to which one might say that the demobilisation of the paramilitaries themselves have been a success. A good number of those that were allegedly demobilised appear to be reconstituting themselves in groups that are now known as criminal groups or criminal bands, and there's speculation that there's between 5 and 12,000 such members of those groups. Not been a total failure, but nor has even the demobilisation process been an absolute success. And I think one of the big failures in the demobilisation process of the paramilitaries themselves was the question of really monitoring properly the level of participation and the nature of participation of the people in the groups that were being demobilised, and ways in which to register the nature of their future activities. It was an opportunity missed. But the biggest difficulty in all of this, Marcy highlighted this question of over-judicialisation and the use of the courts. The biggest difficulty with the paramilitaries was that they had, broadly speaking, hardly ever been investigated by the national criminal authorities. There had been one or two incidents, or let's say a few incidents, that were so notorious that they couldn't be ignored. But there was an incredibly high level of impunity, not only that they hadn't been prosecuted, but they hadn't been investigated, which indicates a level of obviously more or less direct relations with agents of the state, be it at the justice level or at the commission level through the military or the police. The situation with FARC is entirely different. There have been thousands upon thousands of prosecution of FARC. The hierarchies of the FARC and other left-wing groups have all been prosecuted. A good number of them are in prison. A large number, of course, are still at large and were prosecuted and convicted in absentia. The question really is not to devise a similar mechanism that has proved immensely complicated in its execution in relation to the paramilitaries for this so-called justice and peace process, which is effectively a prosecution and a conviction with a reduced sentence deal. That's not what's needed here. The issue here is, under which conditions can senior leaders of FARC and other parties connected to FARC serve appropriate sentences, and what conditions might be imposed on those kinds of sentences. So it's an entirely different question, entirely different model required, and the lessons from the paramilitary justice and peace process, in my view, are almost entirely separate, really, from the ways in which the FARC issue has to be addressed.
Moving on to the remaining two issues that we will briefly address in this broadcast, Nepal. Nepal, in its peace accords, had the requirements that resulted in these two proposed bills, one on Truth and Reconciliation Commission, the other on Commission of Enforced Disappearances. This initiative has been stalled for a number of years. Nepal is amidst a parliamentary crisis with its legislative assembly dissolved. However, we seem to be seeing a breakthrough of sorts. A few days ago, an ordinance unifying these two bills into one has been presented by a group of ministers to the president, which would see establishment of a truth commission in Nepal. There is a number of issues around this ordinance that various different civil society groups, victim groups, and others have reacted to. Marcy, can you please walk us through the significance of this development, possibly why now, and what are the issues that we are particularly interested in here?
Yes. Well, unfortunately, what might have been a really significant step forward has presented everyone with a very problematic situation. It is the case that these bills have been under discussion for 6 years, with no bill finally being approved, and with that being a great indicator of the lack of real political will to address very, very legitimate concerns about the right to truth in Nepal, the right to truth about what happened during the conflict, about the consequences for people, about the need for acknowledgement and redress. This could have been a very important step forward, but unfortunately, while the ordinance has provided some advances and has some very interesting elements to it, there are two provisions which really make the ordinance unacceptable, and if they can't be changed, would make it very, very difficult to celebrate this as a step forward. The one which probably can't be fixed without eliminating it is the article that allows the commission to recommend amnesty for serious violations of human rights, which under international law and practice can't be amnestied. That provision really would need to be eliminated from the ordinance under any circumstances. The other provision, which is very questionable, is one which demands that the commission organize what they call acts of reconciliation or reconciliation events, which would basically be personal encounters between a perpetrator and a victim, which would put the victim under enormous pressure of a variety of forms, which is not acceptable practice. And also allows for the commission itself to declare some event reconciled, even if the perpetrator or victim do not participate in such an event. And that's simply not acceptable. That could be fixed by changing some of the language in that particular article that would take away the more forced elements of this. In general, ICTJ, though, doesn't believe that these kinds of personal encounters are the ways in which truth commissions can really contribute to reconciliation. They can provide information to the missing, to the families of the missing and the disappeared about what happened to their loved ones, and maybe in the best of cases facilitate the return of remains. They can recommend ways in which institutions have to be reformed. That's the real contribution to reconciliation that a truth commission can make, not in organizing interpersonal encounters.
In your view, very briefly, how do you see this moving forward? We have a situation where this has been passed on to the president to enact. Is there space for amendments that you are talking about?
We really don't know if there's a space for amendment. The government has not been particularly open to engaging in discussions with different actors about that. So it's not clear what the space is, unless there's a way of amending it in these ways to eliminate these two worst and unacceptable elements. We would really hope that the president does not sign this into effect, as it's unacceptable in its current form. If it can be sent back and modified, and these modifications are made, then there are, in fact, ways of using this ordinance and its implementation to advance the right to truth for victims.
Lastly, and very briefly, we have seen the first annual report by the newly appointed Special Rapporteur on issues of truth, justice, reparations, and guarantees of non-recurrence. His main message was don't see transitional justice as any sort of soft justice. What would be your comment, Paul, on the report and the tasks ahead for the new Special Rapporteur?
I think the first thing to say is it's an incredibly positive recognition of the challenges that the various aspects of transitional justice faces, that the Human Rights Council has seen fit to appoint a Special Rapporteur on these issues. And obviously his first report is an important way of setting out his stall, if you like, in terms of indicating what the principal issues are. So it's a good opportunity to, in a sense, restate some of the underlying principles and to try and address some of the persistent mischaracterizations and misunderstandings that are sometimes very hard to shift in, if you like, popular understandings. So the report's important. It states very well and very clearly the basic tenet that I think basically is something that Marcy had hinted at earlier on as well, that justice takes various forms, and that if you want to really achieve the maximum opportunity for transitional justice efforts to take hold in establishing accountability and in strengthening democratic institutions to protect fundamental human rights, you have to see all of these things working together. It's not a soft option, it's a complex option, and that we have learned over the years that there are ways in which we can try and do those things better, and there are ways in which we've learned from some kinds of mistakes, but to misunderstand transitional justice as somehow, for example, excluding criminal justice, or in some ways trying to give amnesties, these things are very old-fashioned and rather out-of-date ideas, and the issue is understanding the complexity rather than mischaracterizing it as anything other than proper justice.
On that note, I thank you all for taking part in this inaugural broadcast of ICTJ Forum. The next edition of ICTJ Forum comes to you in 1 month, when again we have ICTJ experts providing you with views and analysis of the most relevant transitional justice developments. Thank you.